The Six Nations protest against the Douglas Creek Estates housing development in Caledonia, Ontario, continued to simmer this weekend, fueled in part by three misconceptions. And the nation-to-nation character of the conflict makes it a matter for international news. In a letter to Gathering Place, Sharon Green's website of First Nations Canadian News, an Aboriginal man who goes by the name of Mike Christian raises the point, quote, "I keep hearing the settlers via the media saying how we as First Nations have been conquered, and they as the conquering force can manipulate us as they see fit, and how because of this conquering, we are all Canadians and our nations no longer exist. When did all this conquering take place?" he asks. "My understanding of Canadian history," he goes on to say, "is that many of the treaties signed in this country were to ensure both First Nations and settlers prospered together," end quote. Mike Christian is right, and he's not splitting hairs. It is generally understood that relations between the indigenous people of this continent and the European colonists took a fundamentally different path on the Canadian side of the border from that eventually taken on the U.S. side. On the U.S. side, that relationship begins with the Declaration of Independence, in which George III is accused, among other things, of endeavoring, quote, "to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." This is not the place to get into the similarities between this description of Indian people and that of suspected terrorists being held as illegal combatants in Guantanamo Bay, but there are scholarly discussions of the subject that make it worth noting for future reference. In the U.S., the century that followed the Declaration of Independence was a century of expansion and Indian wars inspired by genocidal slogans like Andrew Jackson's "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." An act of Congress in 1871 unilaterally renounced the United States' adherence to the international law of Aboriginal and treaty rights. In the U.S., the First Nations were officially seen as enemies. In Canada, they were allies, allies of the Crown, and allies of the local military. The Royal Proclamation of 1763 is the foundation of Canadian Aboriginal law. It is the basis of our understanding of the legal nature of Indian title and an historical root of the treaty process. In the wake of the Seven Years' War, known in the U.S. as the French and Indian War, the Royal Proclamation reserved lands west of the Appalachian height of land to the Indians as their hunting grounds, not to be included in any colony. The proclamation went on to prohibit private persons from purchasing land from the Indians because of, quote, "great frauds and abuses," end quote. Lands ceded by Indian people were to be purchased exclusively by and for the Crown, and settlement was forbidden. Nisga'a Chief Joseph Gosnell referred to this proclamation in his speech to the BC legislature when the Nisga'a Treaty was ready for signing. "We took to heart the promises of King George III," he said, "set out in the Royal Proclamation of 1763, that our lands would not be taken without our permission, and that treaty making was the way the Nisga'a would become part of this new nation." The Proclamation of 1763 was also brought forward during the process of repatriation when it was mentioned in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It would be a mistake to suggest that these differences between the American and the Canadian approach to First Nations people is final or absolute. For example, it is said that Benjamin Franklin was so taken with the Six Nations concept of confederation that he resolved to incorporate it into his plan for the new American Republic. On this side of the border, both the Provincial Liberal Party in BC and the Federal Reform Party declared war on the treaty process in the run up to the signing of the Nisga'a Treaty. There is always a constituency reluctant to give up what its predecessors have taken the trouble to steal. That's why the treaty process has been so slow. The Hollywood myth that all the merciless Indian savages of the New World were conquered as civilization moved west hasn't helped either. And that brings us to a second fundamental misconception. On April 6th, Deirdre McCracken, speaking for the Minister of Indian Affairs, Jim Prentice, on the Caledonia crisis, said, quote, "This is not a land claims matter," and that the blockade, quote, "has nothing to do with the federal government," end quote. In a letter to the editor, Roland Pangawish of the Wickwemecong Unceded Indian Reserve explains, quote, "At issue here are the outstanding fiduciary obligations of the Crown," end quote. Most Canadians are probably more familiar with the fiduciary duty that corporations have toward their shareholders. That is to say, corporations are required to protect shareholders' interests. When a fiduciary duty is imposed, equity requires a stricter standard of behavior than the comparable duty of care under common law. It is said the fiduciary has a duty not to be in a situation where personal interests and fiduciary duty conflict, a duty not to be in a situation where their fiduciary duty conflicts with another fiduciary duty, and a duty not to profit from their fiduciary position without express knowledge and consent. Generally, and in detail, a fiduciary cannot have a conflict of interest. It has been said that fiduciaries must conduct themselves at a level higher than that trodden by the crowd. And so it is for the government in its relation to the First Nations. According to Pangawish, who directs the Assembly of First Nations Land Rights Unit and co-chairs the Joint First Nations Canada Task Force on Specific Claims Policy Reform, the Crown's outstanding fiduciary obligations relate to trust-like responsibilities the Crown unilaterally assumed when it imposed its Indian Act and other laws on First Nations, despite its treaty relationships with most of these First Nations. Pangawish says, quote, "Time and again, it is proven that federal officials did not secure the interests of Indians in a myriad of reserve land surrenders across Canada. The building of Canada's railways brought about a number of classic cases where Crown officials and politicians colluded with developers to swindle First Nations out of reserve lands without adequate compensation." Pangawish points out that Canada's Bill C-6, the Specific Claims Resolution Act, sits on the books unimplemented because the Liberal government could not bring itself to eliminate the conflict of interest in handling legal claims against itself. Pangawish says, quote, "Canadians who want to talk about the rule of law should look at the conflict of interest their governments are engaged in when it comes to resolving outstanding land claims," end quote. In the present case, General Haldimand proclaimed in 1784 that Britain would protect the Six Nations' right to occupy the land for 6 miles on either side of the Grand River from its mouth to its source, that is, from Kitchener to Lake Erie. This protection was offered by a grateful British crown in compensation to its Indian allies who had lost land in New York State during the American Revolutionary War. The original 950,000 acres of the so-called Haldimand Tract was downgraded in 1795 by Lieutenant Governor John Simcoe to 270,000 acres. Last week, protesters pointed out that the Six Nations Reserve outside Brantford now covers less than 5% of the original tract. Much of the land was taken away for public projects. In 1982, the elected Six Nations Band Council filed the first of 29 land claims. One deals with the land along Plank Road, which the claim says was taken from them and sold to third parties in 1841. That road is now Highway 6. Some of the land was taken without compensation for the Welland Canal, while money due them helped finance the construction of McGill University. So far, only one of their claims has been settled. In 1985, band members voted to accept $610,000 to settle a dispute with Canadian National Railway over 80 acres on the eastern border of the reserve. Not only were Canada's native people not conquered, they have not been protected by the Crown, especially against the Crown's own demands for land. A third misconception entails the contradictions that remain when one form of democracy is enforced at the expense of another. In late March, John and Don Henning of Henco Industries Limited, the developers building Douglas Creek Estates subdivision on part of the Haldimand Tract, issued a press release stating that, quote, "We are being held hostage between a splinter group and the federal government, a situation over which we have no control," end quote. Without in any way diminishing the frustration of Henco Industries, it is naive to think of the Klan mothers, the elders, and the Confederacy Council as splinter groups. They are the originals. Band councils were imposed by the federal government in 1924. The Six Nations Confederacy has been called the oldest living participatory democracy on earth. Hazel Hill, one of the women active at the blockade, describes how decisions are made. There are 50 chiefs, which represent the Confederacy Council, and there is a clan mother with each chief. It is the people whose voice the chiefs and clan mothers carry. Any decision regarding land comes first from the women and then to their clans, and through the process of our council, when all are in agreement or when consensus has been reached, only then does the decision stand, she says. In our history of the Haldimand Tract, this has never been done. This may be hard for Canadians to grasp who have not elected a woman as prime minister or provincial premier for the country's entire history and who for part of that time didn't allow women to vote. That's it for this Monday. This edition of World Report has been archived on the World Report website at cjly.net/worldreport, where you can get it either as a podcast or in raw MP3 format. There are also links to recommended sources of further reading if you're interested. To comment or suggest a story, send email to earthling@cjly.net, attention World Report, or to Box 767, Nelson, British Columbia, Canada, V1L 5R4, attention World Report. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.